I actually thank both of the presenters, and actually let you know that Paige has been in this room for over 2 hours. So. And I also realize that I'm what stands between you, and particularly Nora, leaving this room and getting to go outside. But what is, we actually planned this panel, and it actually has worked out better than I initially thought, because Diane has given me a perfect segue to my talk, so I'm going to speed through a lot of the background that I would have presented had she not done a great job of presenting that. So what my job here is to basically take the socio-ecological model and add the twist of a gender-informed approach. So I'm going to walk you through this, and we're going to take this model and then apply it to a data set. So a lot to do in 20 minutes, but we'll see how it goes. All right, so what's the gender issue? Well, fortunately, you just heard what the gender issue is, and that is the sex symmetry or gender symmetry question. And that is using the conflict tactic scale, and probably everybody in this room knows what I'm talking about when I talk about the conflict tactic scale. It's basically that checklist that Diane talked about, and the respondent answers it based on whether they use the behavior or their partner used the behavior. That's typically how it's used. And what we find is that, particularly in adolescents, but also in older individuals, very similar rates of both using violence victimization as well as perpetration. Now, the question then is, and what I'm hoping to address today, is are women really as aggressive as men? Okay, that's the conundrum that we're in here trying to figure out, I guess. Well, what might explain it? I'm an epidemiologist, so I always look for bias. What factors could explain this other than this really being true, that men are as violent as women? One explanation is measurement error. That is the conflict tactic scale really the appropriate measure? It's basically just looking at behaviors. You have no information about really impact. Okay, we don't know what the context is for that interaction. We don't know what's going on, whether substance abuse is being used, fear as a component, as a motivator. So we also need to consider the effect of gender on behavior in a societal context. So Dr. Hall went through all of this in setting this up. So I recently came across a paper which I think is just great. Kristen Anderson's 2005 paper. And what she's really saying, and I'm going to do this in about 2 minutes, and it's a paper, great read, which I think has really changed at least how I'm thinking about the influence of gender really on the issue of partner violence. But what she's saying is, is it really a problem of methods that we're using? Is it a problem of using the conflict tactic scale? Or is it a problem how we think about gender and sex? Okay. So very quickly, she has three approaches. This comes from the sociologic literature, looking at an individualist approach, which is what we've been doing for a long time. We're basically looking at sex as biology, and basically, that's what we've been looking at. Now, what she's saying is there are other ways to look at gender, and particularly how they affect partner violence. And the second is what she's calling the interactionist approach. And here you're looking at what's going on in the dyad. What's the situation in which what an individual is choosing to use force? So this is, in looking at the situational fact, you're talking about what the other person is doing, but you're also talking about what their motives or understanding their motives, the reasons, and the setting for aggression. And the third, which fits very nicely with the socio-ecologic model, which is a structuralist approach, in looking at the society's influence on the effect of violence on gender. So societal influences in terms of gender. So let me put it all together really quickly. This is the socio-ecologic model that we've all been talking about. And then let me orient you. What I'm going to be talking about is really what factors influence partner violence, the PV in the middle, okay? And what we typically do when we think about looking at violence, we're looking really at what the aggressor is, the perpetrator is doing. And that's really out of context of any of the other components of the socio-ecologic model. So that is Anderson's individualist approach, okay? Well, going beyond that is, of course, as I mentioned, the interactionist approach. And here we're talking about the influence of the couple interacting and also the situational context and how that then influenced partner violence. And the last that we're going to look about here is the structuralist gender approach. And here we're talking about Gender as defined by societal influences or the social environment. Okay. All right. So let me quickly tell you about this cross-sectional and now cohort study. This is actually designed as a cohort, but I'm not going to present the cohort data just yet. We're still working on that. But this was a large community college in Houston, Texas, and what we did was to take the registrar database. This is a publicly available database of this particular community college, and it is a very large community college. There are, at any point in time, about almost 60,000 individuals that are going to this community college. So we tried to do a stratified random sample, and what we did was to try to get a third of the population included in our sample, Hispanic, a third African American, and then a third Caucasian, and I'll show you that we were somewhat successful in that. We were trying to interview about 2,000 individuals. I should mention that this was funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. What we then did is with this information, and of course with informed consent, we then contacted the sampled individuals. We contacted them in one of two ways. If we had email information, we did have email information on the majority, we sent them an email which really just talked about a study. It was looking at relationship experiences. At this level, we weren't specifically identifying this as a study of partner violence because anybody could read this information. So we wanted to have a direct connection with the individual before we explain the full study. We also indicated that if the individual did not want to participate in the study, they could call us or email us and we would not further contact them. Then for those people who were willing to be contacted, we then did interviews by telephone and we trained our interviewers very, very well. We actually, several days of interview training. These are individuals who were either psychologists or social workers who were then working with this with us in this particular study. Who's eligible? These were community college students, ages 18 to 35, and they had to have been in a dating or an intimate relationship, and yes, intimate relationship includes being married. That was a question we got several times, and it was a little surprising. all right, and they had to be in the relationship for the past 12 months. We're really focused on then that 12-month period as being then the focus of our measurements of violence. If an individual reported in the over the interview, and the interview took about 45 minutes on the phone, if they reported partner violence, either victimization or perpetration, or current depression or anxiety, we provided at the end of the interview an outtake, provided resources, and then in some instances were actually on the phone and with them in terms of talking through those feelings. So a lot went into this. So I'm very quickly going to tell you about the study. It was called Project Share. You know, you always have to come up with a catch name. So basically Share means the survey of Houston area relationship experiences. We focus on relationship experiences because you can have good and bad relationship experiences. Okay. This was actually a copy of the flyer that went out in the mailing. And what we discovered as we were going through is to recruit the young men, this is men and women in the study, we needed to have something beyond the $10 gift card. So what we did, we actually did little focus groups with individuals who were in this age group, and we came up with an iPod. Actually, we gave an iPod a week. So your chances of getting an iPod were pretty good in this study. And this was done at the University of Texas Health Science Center School of Public Health. All right, what was in this 45-minute questionnaire? Well, are you guys able to hear me all right? I'm wandering here. Okay, all right. The items that were included in this questionnaire, and I'm going to give you a brief listing, as we looked at both victimization, perpetration of partner violence. By that I mean physical partner violence, sexual violence, coercion, stalking, and psychological abuse. So you ask bidirectionally all of those items. You can see why it was 45 minutes. We also included information on past partner violence, victimization, perpetration. So beyond the past 12 months, what was going on before this point in time. We have questions on familial history of abuse, many of the items that Diane Hall just talked about in terms of the partner violence between the individuals in the family of origin or child abuse, we included. Use of alcohol at the time of a specific event or problem alcohol use in the partner of or the individual. And then we include a lot of information on past violent behaviors, conduct disorder is part of that, and criminal behavior, particularly being arrested. We were looking at the original question for the grant, not what I'm going to talk about here, but the original question was looking actually at the psychological profiles as Holdsmith Monroe was presenting, looking at personality disorders and how that may increase risk of violence. All right, who were our subjects? We interviewed a total of 1,863 individuals, and what I'm doing here, since I'm looking at the issue of gender, is really focus it on men and women who were in relationships the past 12 months that were defined as opposite sex. Their partner was of the opposite sex. So what we find really quickly is that women were, on average, older, and they were much more likely to be married. And this is women in community college sample. In addition, we find that in this sample, we have more women than men that are African American. And last thing I wanted to mention here is that men were more likely to report more sex partners in the past 12 months. Big surprise there. All right. The other thing I wanted to mention is I was trying to get a third, and we did pretty well in our sample with Hispanic individuals. And African American. We didn't do as well with white individuals in the population, and we had more Asian and mixed race in our sample. All right, now I want to look at the other side of this. We asked the individuals to tell us about themselves and then also about the partner. So these are the attributes of the partner. Same setup in the slide. What we see then is that men are more likely to report their female partner to be unemployed. There were no differences in education between the two or in ethnicity. However, women were more likely to report that they were about 2 years younger than their partner. And women were more likely to report that they believed their partner had a drug or an alcohol problem. All right, let's go back to the model. What I want to do, and really quickly going through testing this model in terms of the gender differences. And so we're going to focus first, not surprisingly, on the individualist approach to defining it. So we're basically just looking at the aggressor, and that is the individual, the respondent, who chooses to use force against a partner. That's how I'm defining that. So this hypothesis, Anderson would say, men will have greater rates of physical aggression, that is, using force against a partner, than will women. That's the hypothesis. And then let me walk you through this test very quickly. We're looking here at the prevalence of partner violence, and here I'm defining it as physical aggression. Okay? So it's the respondent telling us that they use force against their partner, and it's their main partner in the past 12 months. And what we see here is that men are, 60% of men report they use some form of physical aggression against a partner in the past 12 months, compared to 50% of women. So for this particular item, men are more likely to use physical aggression against the partner. Now, you might say, oh my God, 50% of women and 60% of men are using some form of violence. And I think that this is where you have to think about the tools that we're using. We're using the conflict tactic scale, which is, I'm providing a little note to this end. And we used actually the severity of violence against men and women as well. So it's 15 tactics, and they can use this in any context. Okay? So that's where we get higher rates, when we're asking people to tell us about any use of these tactics, and then we ask about the context, which is important for the next slide. But when we restrict then the definition of physical violence to severe physical violence or did you injure a partner, then you can see no gender differences in terms of those two attributes. And when we talk about stalking a partner, in other words, we're asking the subject to tell us about their stalking behaviors to her partner, we didn't see no differences there either. We do see a slight difference, not statistically significant at the 0.01 level, but we see a greater proportion of men reporting forcing their partner to have sex relative to women. All right, well, what does that mean in terms of Anderson's application to the SEM model, which again, hypothesis, men would be more likely to would have higher rates of using partner violence. We find that that is true. 60% of men report using some form of aggression compared to 50%. But we don't see gender differences. In fact, we find gender symmetry, if you will, with severe physical aggression, injuring a partner, and stalking. So that would lead us to reject that hypothesis. All right, let's go up a level, if you will. Now we're talking about the interactionist approach. So we're here thinking about the context, meaning, and motive for using aggression, and we'd hypothesize that that would be different for men and for women. Okay, so what we're now doing is I'm doing a little switch on you, so I need to talk you through this. We're really saying then that the correlates of aggression would differ by gender. So we're looking now within gender, and we're going to be looking at what the partner is doing. Okay, so we're looking at the behaviors, self-reported behaviors of the subject, and then we're asking them to tell us about what was going on essentially in that relationship in terms of what violent tactics the partner might be using. We also looked at substance abuse the last time the person reported violence. So we're saying the context in terms of substance use last time that they reported violence. And then we're looking at what's going on. Essentially, is it really conflict? Is it another setting? So let me walk you through this. First, we're looking at what's going on in terms of what's the partner doing. So what we're looking at here is we're using linear regression, and we're looking at then regression parameter estimates within men and within women. The outcome, if you will, the independent variable is the scores for physical partner violence aggression. Okay. So what do we find? Well, we find that for both men and for women, you see higher aggression scores, self-reported aggression, their use of aggression, if the partner is also using partner violence. Not a surprise. This is really, you can sum up this slide with mutual aggression. That's the way to think about this, because basically, if the partner is using, then they're reporting that they're using. And that's true, actually, for psychological abuse, stalking, to a lesser degree, forced sex, and being injured by a partner. All right. Now we're going to shift a little bit. The outcome is the same, but we're looking exclusively among people who reported that they used physical aggression. And we want to look at is the context in terms of whether there's alcohol or drugs involved. Okay, and all of this is self-report. That's really the only way you can get this information. So what do we find? Well, we find a really different pattern here. We're seeing that among women, not compared to men, but among women, higher physical aggression scores are associated with either the respondent or the partner using alcohol or drugs. And that's true for the respondent only using and the partner only using. So we do see a difference here in terms of context. All right, I need to give you a little bit of background for this next part because it's a little tricky. So to assess context for the last use of physically aggressive episode, then the respondents were asked to tell us what was going on the last time that they used any of the range of 15 tactics. Okay? Then we looked through, I cannot tell you how many lines of open-ended responses. And what we came up with was really very consistently three categories. And I'm some oversimplifying it for the purposes of this talk, but basically we had one group which were, they're using this particular tactic in a joking or playful manner, or they were using it during foreplay or sex, and that was particularly the two were biting and choking fell into this category. And then the last was really during a fight or some sort of disagreement, the typical conflict kind of setting, that which is what we think of when we think about dating violence. All right, what do we find? Well, again, same regression. We're looking at predicting levels of physical aggression. And what we find then is we find a difference based on gender here that among women, not compared to men, but among women, they're more likely to report higher scores if the last use of force was surrounding a conflict. However, that's for men. It's really higher scores associated with their reporting that the last episode was sexual in nature. And we're comparing those two categories to playful. All right. Now, going back to that interactionist approach, we would hypothesize gender differences in the situational context, and we actually did not find any differences in terms of what I'm going to term the mutual violence, okay? But we did find differences in terms of the context being substance use. That is, women were more likely to report that they were using force when there was substance use going on. And the last is we did find another difference in terms of the situational context, in terms of what they attributed the reason for the violence to be. Okay. Now, we're going to go to the top of it, going out to the very extremes here in the socio-ecological model and looking at the social environment using the structuralist approach. And that Anderson is hypothesizing then the consequences or the impact of partner violence will be greater for women. And we look at three aspects here. We're looking at the victimization score, increasing score, increasing rates of injury, and also increasing rates of dysphoric scores like anxiety, depression, and dissociation. All right. Here then we're comparing men to women, and we're comparing the rates of receiving, or another way to say that is victimization. And what we find is that, and this is a little surprising, that men have higher victimization scores than do women. And that is true when we look at the subsets of chronic physical partner violence, and that's defined as using the particular tactic more than once. And these are higher scores. And also more severe violence. Men report higher scores. There are no differences in psychological abuse victimization in men and women in this study, and no differences at the 0.01 level in stalking scores. All right. Now we're looking at the definition of violence in terms of impact and help seeking. So what we're finding here is a difference by gender that women are more likely to report being injured by a partner. That's not new. Dr. Hall just mentioned that. Women are also more likely to seek help, as is indicated here, and they're more likely to see violence as a problem. That's an direct impact measure. All right. Lastly, we looked at the issue of dysphoria, and we find that women, these are all among women who are reporting any violence victimization, physical violence victimization, women had higher anxiety symptom scores, had higher depression scores, and higher dissociation scores. And I forgot to mention on the first slide on this orientation, we adjusted all of these analyses for age, differences in partner age, difference between the partner's age, and here physical IPV perpetration and number of partners and race. All of the slides you've seen before are adjusted. All right, so what does this mean then in terms of testing that the structuralist approach that in terms of the socio-ecological model? Well, we did find that physical partner violence scores among victims were higher for men than for women. I'm not sure how to interpret that in terms of what we would perhaps hypothesize. But we did find differences in two other areas, that women were significantly more likely to report being injured, seeing partner violence as a problem, and seeking help. And the third point, partner violence is associated with higher dysphoria scores for women than for men. And those last two do support the hypothesis in terms of the structural approach. All right. We have to mention our limitations, and there are a number, and I'm only going to talk about three, and I'm sure we can come up with others, but this is not a couple study. So we can't infer that the gender differences in violence are a reflection of the mutual or the unidirectional violence in the dyad. We're basically asking one individual in the couplehood to talk about the behaviors of the other and not really having the data from that other member to validate that. These are cross-stational data. We don't know how gender influences beginning to use force, and that's actually our next analyses. And these are all self-reported data. And to the extent that gender influences accurate reporting of aggression, and I refer you to Archer 2000 and the many responses to Archer 2000, then our data may be biased in that way. All right, future directions, we need more quantitative and we need more qualitative work to better understand the motives, the situational context, the level of fear, how women are responding, how men are responding, what do they see is really going on. And to really look at the question of gender and how that influences partner violence. And of course, we need cohort data to address the gender contextual factors that predict violence incidence as well as desistance. So that's it for me, and let's open it up to any questions you guys have. Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Developed, and it's getting at a different aspect, and it really hasn't been validated for use with men. But that's another way. I mean, I think one of the things to think about is you don't want to use just one measure. Just as Diane Hall mentioned, that, and you're not related, right? But I think you want to look at not only the range of different types of partner violence, which was really important in this particular study, but you also want to use different aspects in defining partner violence. It's even physical partner violence, because you're really getting at multiple components that I think are really important. So I think it's an appropriate way to look at context, to ask what's going on, if you can get sufficient, if you can really get that information. Sometimes it's really hard to ask that and really get what you want in a telephone-based interview. That's a challenge.
When we look and use the web and a CTS or a similar measure, and say a measure of sexual abuse, we get overlapping circles. Mm-hmm. So they're not just measuring, they may be measuring different things. Okay. So that you have women who would be positive on one and negative on the other, vice versa. So they may not actually be measuring the same thing.
And that's one of the additional criticisms of the CTS, is that the direction for it is that you're supposed to be responding about what occurred in the context of a conflict, but a lot of times you get these things, but we were joking, we were doing this. And so one of the suggestions is that you are measuring something very different than, say, a battering situation. So that is something to keep in mind. But on the other hand, you have to, as a researcher, you have to figure out how to ask these questions somehow. And so I think if someone were to develop something instead of the CTS, it would end up looking a lot like a checklist, maybe with some additional open-ended questions. So the key is, it's a tool. So.
Yeah. Do you know of any means to control for self-selection bias in these types of surveys?
The question is, how do we control for self-selection bias? It's difficult. Many researchers use some measures of social acceptability, and I think we certainly collected that information, but then what do you do with it too? I mean, do you really just put it in a regression model? I think it's really important to, of course, dug in information about response rates, but actually perhaps to maybe even do some postdoc adjustment along those lines. But I welcome your thoughts on that.
Because I think that would be, my immediate response is that someone who is an active abuser in a relationship would be unlikely to want to talk about their relationship. And so, that's kind of self-selection bias that I would think would be kind of endemic. And I think they're kind of.
You
endemic.
Do one of the IRB.
I agree with you, and I was really surprised that we had as much recording of violence. I mean, self-selection would suggest that we would have much lower rates than we actually have. But I think it depends on how you allow people to answer the questions, And we decided to leave it open-ended in terms of the context to really get at that, because there may be some discounting of violence. You can call it something else,
said it's not violence, and so you feel okay with reporting it.
Sort of a follow-up, given that you used a telephone versus in-person, mm-hmm. how would you hypothesize that that may have been more different in the sense that maybe people felt the opposite of what you normally think, more secure to just close because they're not in front of someone answering the questions versus, say, a computer-assisted or even other means in which she's doing.
And there's a whole literature behind that. And a lot of that literature hasn't actually looked at the personality traits. I mean, because we probably sit in this room and some of us would say, I would be much more likely to disclose if I'm talking to someone directly and I had a relationship, you know, with that person. The whole issue of screening in clinics is very much this issue. And we're going round and round right now on that therapy issue because some people are very comfortable at a computer and others are not at all, you know. So I think there's an issue not only of the sensitivity of the topic, but just basic personalities along those lines. Sherry?
Oh, well, and I was just thinking about the, I just have a real problem with the labeling of mutual violence, especially when we're using behavioral checklists. So, I mean, it's mutual in the sense that men and women are both reporting that they're perpetrating violence, but it still doesn't, to me that's not context.
Yes,
okay, well, even in the, like, Caetano's couple survey, you know, and they're both reporting, and the same couple are both reporting that they perpetrate violence at similar levels, but you still don't know, I mean, is that a response to the other person? And I don't doubt that women are violent, but I don't think we really have, I don't think we have the proof in terms of what that means. It's just, it's really frustrating.
It is frustrating. And I think, I really think we've got to add a component to, if we really continue to use CTS, and we've been using it for the length of time we've been using it, I can imagine we will continue to, just in terms of comparison. But I think we have to add questions to get at context. I mean, what they perceive to be going on at that particular time, and what else, you know, not just that, but what else is going on in the relationship.
The other question I have is about the men more often reporting that, I'm not sure if I understood what you're saying, that men were reporting that their sexual violence was occurring as part of sex, and it was confusing here. Are you saying they perceive that their behaviors were just having sex?
That's pretty much it. So
they committed to
we're asking kind of what was going on. This is a question that we're asking. The last time that you did X, Y, or Z, and we have a specific tactic, then we followed up with what was going on the last time. And so that's where we then have these groupings that were very consistent in terms of how what they perceived when they were last using perp force, what was going on at that point in time.
So they could report hitting or choking or whatever, mm-hmm. those physical.
Correct.
So they weren't saying that their sexual violence was just sex play. It was more than physical.
We only asked those for physical, yes.
One thing about your earlier question, I just want to add, I think that when we think about gender at the structural level, we can ask ourselves the question of why is aggression acceptable, an acceptable way of getting what you want. Mm-hmm. And we live in a very masculine world that says that this is the way to get what you want, but through these different types of aggression. Women learn the same thing. We know that aggression and might be the way to get what we want, and we may as well do that too, particularly if we feel that vulnerable or in some sort of uncertain situation, because that's what our society teaches us to do. And this is where we have to drop back and punt. And we need to ask ourselves, why is this what we're teaching people as the acceptable way of defining and enforcing situations? And how do we reframe that so that there are other ways getting what you want, or understanding that what other people want is okay too, and ask ourselves these kinds of larger questions, because we would be foolish to think that women aren't going to pick up, particularly if they've been victimized, that this is the way you get what you want.
I think one of the other, I'd also like to comment on the first question, is that we shorthand things just to make it easier to communicate, and so we say sex symmetry or sex asymmetry or mutual violence or bidirectional violence or things like that. But I think with the state of the literature the way it is, I have a tendency, I probably annoy my colleagues a lot, but I make them use more words. And so what we know is that when we use a behavioral checklist, looking at the use of physical aggression in the context of a conflict, males and females reporting using similar levels, which is what we know. it's really annoying. It uses way too many words, but it very clearly tells you what we know. As soon as you start shorthanding too much, it gives you a completely different picture of something, and we're not at that point in the research because we don't get the context information, or because we're using the CTS when we've really got a battered situation, and so we're losing some of the power and control dynamics or things like that. I'm sure my colleagues find me annoying, but I think that being more precise in our language is probably a good thing for us to do as professionals.
And there's really almost no resources for men who are not court ordered into battered treatment as a specific example. So there are people who are screening for partner violence victims that can for patients, men and women. The question is then, you know,
want to do that?
That, well, you know, the Preventive Health Task Force.
Sorry.
The Preventive Health Task Force is not recommended to screen.
Right. That's sort of where I was going.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of, for all of what we've talked about in terms of preventing violence, in terms of identifying those risk factors, we've got a lot of work to do to evaluate whether screening actually result in better outcomes from an implementer. That's a huge area.
I think actually a lot of us would advocate that we're really not screening. If you look at the public health and your meeting of the word, we are not screening. We are assessing, identifying key findings, you know, from the whole spectrum from unexposed, no risk factors, through to full-blown disease. And so, and that's, you know, identifying, you know, whoever they are, assessing them, and information, resources, given the magnitude of the problem, the public health magnitude of the problem,
Exactly. So,
but screening, you know, for the, in a lot of the
trial. Yeah. Any other questions? of announcements. There, we've added, Women's Caucus has added a section, and it's at 8:30 tomorrow. I'm telling you because I don't want to be the only one in the room at that point in time, but there's a section added tomorrow. It was actually a replacement. So in your books, this will not appear, so this is your chance to find out. It's the health effects and costs of violence against women, and that will be in Rancho Las Palmas in this hotel. 8:30. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So you see the information.
Oh, God, yes. I was going to say how very Unitarian of you.
And then,
yeah.